All right. Hi, I'm Greg Brockman, and I am giving the Dynamic Websites on Rails talk. So today we're going to explore Ruby on Rails and figure out why Ruby on Rails is one of the coolest things ever invented. All right, so let's get started. So first of all, question that's probably foremost in everyone's mind is, what is Ruby on Rails? Well, so from the website, Ruby on Rails is an open source web framework that's optimized for programmer happiness and sustainable productivity. Beautiful code, favoring convention over configuration. Okay, so that's a lot of words, but what does this mean? Well, first of all, you shouldn't have to write any annoying setup code. You should be able to go from zero to having a functional application that you can take and then modify to do the sort of things that you want to do. So, has anyone here started on the latest CS50 assignment? A little bit? Okay, so you're going to be working with PHP in that one. You're going to have to kind of write everything from the ground up. And you'll realize that there are a lot of tasks that are very general that you want to do in any sort of web application, so just in terms of the way that you process a user's request. And Ruby on Rails takes care of that and just does it automagically. The second thing is you want to get stuff done. So in web, the number one limited resource is programmer time. It's not about the runtime of your program, like you guys probably ran into with your speller, right? There you wanted to spend as much time as you could to make your program run really, really fast. But on the web, most things are not very computationally intensive. And so you just want to get things done in as little time as possible. And the third thing is be happy. All right? That one I don't think I have to explain why. That's good. All right. So what's the history of Rails? Well, in July of 2004, Rails 0.5 was open sourced by David Hansen. And so he's kind of the head Rails honcho. In 2005, Rails 1.0 was released. August 2006, big step for Rails was that Apple decides to ship this natively with Leopard. And 2007, we got Rails 2.0, and soon-ish is going to be Rails 3. So Rails 3 was slated for release this summer. Hasn't quite happened yet. But if you notice, there's a pretty steady interval between releases. It's about 2 years, and if you consider the amount of complexity that's added at each level, you'll actually realize that there's a lot more development that's done. It's basically increasingly an amount of work is being done on Rails. People are getting really excited about it, making it really awesome. So I'm really looking forward to Rails 3. There are some things in Rails 2 that are kind of eh, and they're kind of nuking most of those. So looking forward to that. So this slide's a little bit smaller than I was hoping it was going to be, but anyway, so who uses Rails? Well, that's Twitter if you can't recognize it. Can anyone tell what this one is? Yay, Hulu. This is Lighthouse, which is a bug tracking system, and yellowpages.com if you use that. So anyway, so first of all, Ruby on Rails is really a conglomeration of two things that you guys probably don't know yet. So the first is Ruby. This is a programming language just like C, just like PHP, just like Perl. It's used for scripting. People use it. I know this one company that uses it for a lot of text processing things. It's just really nice, and it really exemplifies the ideas behind Rails in terms of you want to be able to be concise and write very pretty code. So, of course, everyone has to write a hello world program. Here's how you do it. You just say puts and then hello world. So puts, what that does is it prints something to standard out and then puts a new line at the end. If you don't want the new line, you can just say print. And then, of course, you guys know how the whole shebang thing works? Yes? No? Does anyone not know what this is? Okay, this is just a Unix thing. If you have a script that you want to be executable, you up at the top put the hash bang and then the path to the interpreter. And so that's something you'd see for Python or PHP as well. So, of course, you can get more complicated. And so right here is a solution to your sixth pset. So I don't know how many lines it took you guys to do this in C, probably on the order of about 300. This right here reads in a dictionary and then checks a document and prints out any misspelled words. So all that's going on here is you just grab argv of 0, put that in dict. So this is a slight difference from C. In C, argv of 0 is the actual program name. In Ruby, it's the first argument. So you grab the first argument, grab the second argument, and then you pull up a hash table, and you just say that, okay, for each line in the dictionary, I want to put this into the hash table, mark it as one, and then you read out the document, you split on anything that is not a word character, and then you print out misspelled word if it's not in your hash table. So very simple. This is the kind of thing that Ruby does really, really well. This is lovely. Okay, so you can use it in the same sort of way you'd use C or PHP, right? You can just write out assignments, and then you can do an if statement, and then print something. I mean, you can do the same sort of thing. All these languages are equivalent in that sense. But the thing that makes Ruby really cool are the things that it does differently. So first of all, everything is an object. So you guys haven't talked about object-oriented programming. Correct me if I'm wrong. Okay, so the idea behind object-oriented programming is that an object is just some abstraction. It's a container for some functions, which are called instance methods, and values, which are called instance variables. And so basically you say, you bundle these up and you say these all belong to some logical structure. For example, one could think about a person object. And so a person could have a method that's say. And so you pass in some text, and then the person does some semantic sort of thing where they say the text that you just passed in. They could also have attributes such as name or address. And so you logically bundle these things together, and then you can forget about how you implemented them. Because now you have a standard interface. You don't have to worry about if it's stored in a text document or in a MySQL database. The point is that you just have to do object.say, and everything just works. So object-oriented programming is very general, goes beyond Ruby, but in Ruby, we take it to an extreme and we say that everything's an object. So, is a number an object? Just one. What do you guys think?
Yes.
Yes, it is. What about a string?
Yes.
Yes, it is. And what about nil?
No.
So, nil is an object. In Ruby, everything, absolutely everything is an object. So, here are some examples. So, IRB is the interactive Ruby interpreter. And so this is a program that you can get, and you just run in the command line, and then you can interactively run Ruby code. So in GDB, you can kind of do this, right? You can kind of run C code, but honestly, like, this is a huge advantage of scripting languages, is that you can do this. So for example, here's a number, 7331, and you can run a dot even method, right? That just belongs to any sort of number. And of course, 7331 is not even. You can also do a split, and so here I'm matching against a regular expression, which is just a space. If you don't know regular expressions yet, I think you guys get to them. You don't have to worry about that too much, but basically you can convert, anything that this matches, it will interpret as a record separator. And so then you end up with a big array, and then nil, and you can ask it if it's nil, and it will tell you yes. Anything else, if you run .nil, it will tell you no. Okay. So this is kind of what object-oriented programming looks like, is you have some sort of thing, and then it has lots of attributes attached to it. And these attributes can be either just values, or they can be methods. Okay. A couple more types of things in Ruby. We have containers, and these are just objects that provide in each instance method. And so containers, you can think of it in concretely like a list. And so this right here is more or less the list of numbers 1, 2, 3, and 4. And so you can do a dot each, and then you pass it this thing called a block, which we'll talk about in a second, which is basically just a portable piece of code. And so then for each object that lives inside of this list, it passes it into the block as a parameter x, and then it puts x. And so the output that you get is just 1, 2, 3, 4. And then the value returned by this whole block and expression is actually just the same thing as the iterable that you pass it in the container. So does this make sense what this code is doing? So instead of doing a for loop where you do for int I equals 0, et cetera, you actually directly use the interface of the object to iterate over it. And so this works out about the same for simple lists like this, where you're iterating over each object. But it's very different in the sense that you can implement very abstract sort of iterable containers, where you actually don't have such a simple mapping, and you can kind of dynamically decide on the fly what sort of thing should be returned by each. So what's a block? A block is just a portable piece of code. It's sort of like a function. The syntax for this in Ruby is that you do param and multiple params if you want, or if there are no parameters, you just leave off the whole thing, and then you do some code, and then you say end. Or alternatively, you can wrap these in curly braces. So stylistically, you generally use this one. If you want to have it be on multiple lines, you use the other one. If you want it to all be on one line. And you just pass it as a parameter for use in a method to specialize how it does whatever it's supposed to do. So for example, we can take this array, I love Ruby on Rails, which of course everyone does, and you can run the dot sort method, and dot sort takes in a block. So in this case, the block is from the start of this curly brace to the end of this curly brace. And all that this block does is this tells you how to compare two elements. So in other words, what sort does is it takes the first two elements, or it probably does some sort of very fancy merge sort type thing, as you guys dealt with before. But it passes those in as x and y, it compares them, and then it uses that to sort. And so if you haven't seen this operator before, it shows up in a lot of different languages. That's called the spaceship operator, and it basically just does an ordering. So it returns 0 if they're the same, negative 1 if the left one is smaller than the right one, and positive 1 if the right one's bigger. And so this is how you can kind of abstract the idea of what it means to be less than or greater than. And so you can do a custom sort. And so this will sort, any idea what this will sort strings by? So if you're doing x.length spaceship y.length, when will it choose one string to come before another string? Exactly. So it sorts them by length. And if you notice, that's exactly what it does here. And if you notice, there's no return statement. So in Ruby, there is a return statement. You can use it, but it doesn't always do what you want it to do, because it will jump out of the last function that was called. If you call it inside of a block, it will still go outside the last function that was called, not just exit the context of your block. And absolutely everything has a return value, which is why you don't actually have to use the return keyword. You can just have the last thing that you want to return be just there in line. So here, what's returned is the value of this expression, and that's what's passed out of the block. So this is also true of functions. This is true of if statements. So you can do assignments based on if statements. It's all very nice and very concise, because you don't have to deal with explicitly saying return, explicitly putting these things into values, having an if statement that's separate from an assignment, etc. So you can do things as you want to do them. So full set of Ruby keywords, thanks to this website, is alias and, begin, etc., etc., etc. OK. So this is not very important, right? It's a small set of keywords. You can't overwrite them. Don't try to have variables that are called any of these things, or bad things will happen to you. So there are a few other important things about Ruby that we're going to need to talk about before we can even talk about Rails. One is sigils. So in PHP, you put a dollar sign before every single variable. Well, this is pretty lame, right? Because if you do this before every single variable, then you're just typing an extra character all the time, and you're not really getting anything out of it. It doesn't denote anything really special. So in Ruby, it's the flip side. You only have to use a sigil, such as a dollar sign and an ampersand, if you want to indicate a variable that has special scope. You want to say that there's something special about this particular variable. So one thing is that if you want to do a global, you put a dollar sign in front of it. So if you were to try to take your PHP style and put dollar signs before everything, absolutely everything would be global, and then you'd be doing C, basically. An instance variable, which is just a variable that belongs to an object, is represented with an at before its name. And if you're using an intelligent text editor such as Emacs, everything will be nicely syntax highlighted for you. And if you put a colon before your name, so this is actually not for a variable. This is for denoting a symbol. And so a symbol is basically just a space-efficient string. So internally what it does is it stores these things just once, and they're guaranteed to be immutable. So basically, the way that they're represented in memory is you have some string table, and this thing is just a pointer to a specific thing in that table. And they're useful to use.
So
I'll get to blocks in a second. Okay, they're useful to use as keys in hashes. And we'll get to keys and hashes in a second. But basically, it's just a string. You'll see it a lot, and you'll be like, why are they doing that? And it's just like, there's no need to not do that. So if you have a choice between using a string and using a symbol, you should just use the symbol. If you don't need to edit anything, if you don't need to modify it. So, all right, you can also do a block with an ampersand before it, and then basically this just means that you can pass it around as a parameter. Not too important how that actually works unless you really start to get into some more intense things, if you start doing some custom functions and such. But okay, so in Ruby, hashes are built in. So did any of you guys do a hash table implementation for PSET 6? Nope. Did you guys all do tries? The try is much more interesting. But so in Ruby, hashes are built in. So hashes are absolutely essential in all sorts of programming applications, right? Basically, they just allow you to do associative arrays. They allow you to map arbitrary values to arbitrary values. So in Ruby, it's actually true that you can do, you don't have to implement your own hash functions, et cetera, et cetera. It's all built in. It's all magical. It's all behind the scenes. And so this one looks like it's a little bit cut off, but basically what you can do is you just define f, and then you can have some key, arrow, some value, z, arrow, some value, et cetera. And then clearly my return value is wrong here. Ignore that part. But anyway, so now if you do an f and you look up x, where, again, this colon represents a symbol, it's just some string-like thing, then it gets the corresponding value out. You can look up f of z, and you get out this value. And you can even do f of z, and then you get out, this is what was stored over there off the screen. So if you were psychic, you would know that. And so you often use symbols as keys. And any suggestions as to why you might want to use a symbol as your key rather than just like some random string or something? Exactly, right? You usually use these as just like to remember, okay, so this was just what x was or something, and so you can just look it up later. You don't need to change what the keys are. So it's much more efficient just to use symbols, and you'll see that a lot in Rails. Okay, so for function arguments, you don't always have to put in the parentheses. You can pretty much always just leave off the parens unless things start to get ambiguous. If things get ambiguous, you should put the parens in. So it never hurts to put parens in, but generally it looks a lot prettier if you don't. So if you have your hash as the last argument and you're not using parentheses, then you absolutely have to leave off those braces. And any guesses as to why you have to leave off those braces? And the answer is it's a syntactical reason. So any guesses? Does anyone remember what the syntax for blocks was? Remember, with blocks, you put things in curly braces. And with hashes, you put things in curly braces. So basically, it wouldn't be able to tell the difference between a block that you're passing it and a hash that you're passing it. So you have to leave off those curly braces, and so you'll kind of see this magic. All that this means is that this is a hash that contains foo points to you and bar points to me. All right, and so this idiom is used all over in Rails. You pass it generally as an options hash to specify how a method should behave. And all right, so model view controller. So now we're kind of out of the syntax. We're out of how Ruby works. We're done with that. Now time to talk about the more general programming idiom that is used in Rails and pretty much any other web application. And actually, in not just web applications, it's used all over. So the idea behind model view controller. Well, first of all, when you're writing an application, you could just put it all in one big file. But this is a terrible idea, right? I'm sure you guys have seen that sometimes when your C source files get rather large-ish, it gets hard to find things. You don't really know where errors start to come from. If you can't compile the file, then suddenly everything's broken. You don't have anything that works anymore. So it's a good idea in general to break things up, makes it more modular, reusable, etc. There are lots of buzzwords that could go here. Hard to test, hard to read, hard to maintain. Just bad. Don't do it. So the solution is that you should separate the logical parts of your program. You should figure out what parts depend on each other and move them into separate logical places. So model view controller is just a formalized model for doing this. So all right, so what is this whole model view controller thing? So first of all, there are three parts to it, in case you didn't guess that. There's the model. And so this is just something that deals with data. So it talks to the database, stores internal data structures. It deals with the representation, the low-level representation of the data. It doesn't really care about how you're going to use it. It doesn't care about how the user wants to see it. So this, in your spelling program, could be something like it takes care of the hash table. So here, this thing says model, and it's talking to MySQL. Okay. So now the controller handles requests from the world. So when someone sends in a sends in a request from just some browser when you're going to a website, it talks to the controller. The controller looks at the URL, figures out what this person's trying to do, talks to the model, grabs whatever data is needed, plugs that into the view, and then spits out whatever HTML is returned by the view. And so this is cut off as well. Oh, that's lame. But anyway, views generate something pretty. All right, it's just HTML or whatever it is that you need. So essentially, there's this interface between the three of them. You abstract the details of how they're implemented, so this way you can maintain it, and also you can kind of pass it off to your friend, and as long as your friend keeps the same interface between the two, they can deal with whatever sort of internal representation they want. And so what this means is if you decide to swap out for a more efficient representation or you don't like how things are done internally, you can do it without having to rewrite the entire application. And so this is absolutely critical in any sort of real-world application. All right, so let's make a Ruby on Rails application. All right, finally up to Rails. That was only about 15 minutes worth of background. That's not bad. All right, so in order to do that, first of all, you should think about what you're trying to do. Right, so whenever you're going to make a program, you should always have a problem in mind that you're trying to solve. And since you're writing a program, that means that you're trying to solve that problem, you better have a solution in mind. You could sit down and just start writing out code, but generally that doesn't go anywhere. So identify a problem, spec out a solution. It's a very good approach. So here's a problem that I thought is important. This is actually something I've been meaning to write for a while, so good thing I'm giving this talk so that I can write it. So an organization such as Harvard Computer Society, shameless plug for Harvard Computer Society, which is awesome, people often want to have other people review externally facing emails before sending them, right? So basically, maybe I have an announcement that wants to go out at 10 that I want to send out, and I want people to review it before I send it in case I said something stupid, but I also don't want to have to wait for them to, you know, maybe no one's going to respond to my, will anyone read my email thing? And so the idea is to come up with an email queue application. So you put the email into a queue with a send out timestamp that says, okay, if no one responds to my review request by 10 o'clock tomorrow morning, I just want this to automatically be sent out. Okay, so anyone can edit it or update the timestamp, and then once the appointed time is reached, the email gets sent. So does this problem and solution make sense to you guys? Okay, so this is just the general idea of the email queue application. So first of all, let's get started. So we're actually going to see all of this twice. So I'm going to go through it relatively quickly, just on the slides here, so that we get an overview of how Rails works, and then I'm actually going to do it live, assuming that there's enough time. So the first thing you do with a Ruby on Rails application is use Linux. So you can use Windows if you want. I did Rails on Windows for a while, but ultimately, the command line on Windows is just annoying and other things. So I'm going to assume that you're using Linux. But most of what I say is actually going to be applicable to both. So you just say, you go to whatever directory you want to start as the base, and then you type Rails application name. And then Rails goes ahead and creates a bunch of things for you. Remember, convention over configuration, it does all the setup stuff for you. It automatically makes the things that you're going to need anyway. So, all right, so Rails has just built us a new project. And so you can cd into that directory and ls it, or dir if you're on Windows, and you'll see that there are all of these folders. So most of these are folders. README is not a folder, that's just a file, and rakefile is also not a folder. It is a rake file. So let's see what's in here. So first of all, in app, this is where most of your actual code is going to live. So this is where the models, the views, and the controllers live. There's also this other thing called helpers. Helpers is where you might sort of break the MVC abstraction, where helpers does some sort of computational things for the views. So in general, in pure MVC, a view is completely dumb. The controller tells it exactly this is the variable that you're supposed to plug in somewhere, and it just plugs it in. It doesn't call any methods. It doesn't do anything like that. So a helper is where you can kind of cheat, and you can do some more complex view processing. And so basically, this is just Ruby code that you can use and call in your views. So config contains configuration information. So you have boot.rb, and that's just used internally by Rails. You never have to touch it. Something you will have to touch is routes. Routes is how you map externally facing URLs to your models, or to your controllers in particular, and to actions within those controllers. We'll talk about that in a second. Also database.yaml. So first of all, I guess this is a good time to mention what YAML is. YAML is, it stands for, YAML ain't a markup language. And it's a markup language that allows you to structure text in human readable form and machine readable form. It's really great. You can figure out exactly how it works just by looking at one example. So it's pretty simple. Also, there's script. You're going to be running a lot of stuff from within the script directory, but you don't actually have to modify anything here. So there's a ready-made server for you so that you can run your application. There's generate, which allows you to automatically generate some scaffolding, and we'll see exactly how that works. You can also generate other things. There's also a lot of stuff here. Not too much you have to worry about. So that's supposed to say first. So our first model. So let's think. So when you're going to make a model, you should think about what sort of logical objects exist in the world that you're trying to have your application live. So we have an email. That seems like a reasonable place to start. Well, what does an email have? It has someone's being sent to, it has a from, it has a CC, BCC, subject, body, author name, let's say a comma-separated list of editors, and a time to send it at. So these are the attributes that we need to track, the attributes that we want to store in a database. So in order to get this started, you just run script generate, and then, so for those of you that don't know, there's a slash at the end of the line just tells the shell that this is all one contiguous command. Don't start executing until you hit a new line. Without a slash at the end. So script generate scaffold. Scaffold is just something that you get passed, that you pass to generate to say, I want to generate a model and also the corresponding view and controller for this particular object. So email, and then we tell it the types of all of these fields that we want. And so if you notice, it's pretty simple. I want a string for my to, I want a text for my body. I also made editors into a text because it could be long. I think a string is, well, it depends on what your backend is. If you're using MySQL, a string is usually a varchar 255. So what that means is that you only get 255 characters. And so you might have a lot of editors. And so you should store that as a text. And then send that as a date time. So Rails automatically adds three extra fields. One of them is an ID column. And so this just allows you to uniquely identify any particular object that's going to be in your database. You also have a created at timestamp and an updated at timestamp, and those do what you think they do. And so if you notice, Rails has just made us a model view and controller for our email. So at this point, we could go into our Rails application, boot up the server, and start doing some very simple things, which we will talk about. But so first of all, let's take a look at the actual code that was generated. So the initial at models email.rb is very bare bones. So it's just class email descends from active record base end. So this less than just means inherits from or descends from. All that that means is that it should be able to, it should inherit all of the methods that belong to active record base. And so active record base is a Rails thing. It basically contains a lot of magic that makes your models very nice to work with. And so it provides a lot of magic methods, as I said. So you can already do a lot of talking to your database, because that's provided by active record base. And so in code, you could already do email.to. And what that will do is that will read out of the database whatever's stored in there for the to field of this particular object. And it will just be able to use that as a string. And you could also assign to it and save it. And everything will just work. All right. So the initial app views emails provides views for this for four standard actions. So we have an edit, index, new, and show. So these are all views that you want, right? You want to be able to see what your email looks like. You want to be able to edit your email. Index is by default where you list all of the emails that exist in the database. And then new is where you get a form that will allow you to create a new email. And so one buzzword that's important to know is CRUD. So Rails is meant for doing CRUD applications, which is just create, read, update, delete. Those are the four actions you want to be able to do with any particular model. All right, so is this all making sense? So it's a little bit high level, a little bit abstract, but hopefully when we get back to the actual live demo of this, it'll make a little bit more sense. So views. Well, these are written in ERB, which is just embedded Ruby. It's a Ruby templating language. So in, just like in PHP, if you've looked at that at all, you mix and match code with HTML. This means you can just write HTML and it'll just work. Alternatively, you can also embed some dynamic Ruby tags. So the top of show.html is the following. So if you notice, just normal HTML. Ooh, something weird, something that's Ruby specific. And then more HTML, Ruby specific. So this is pretty clear what it's doing qualitatively, right? This is just spitting out the to, the from, and it'll look like that all the way down. It'll, so Ruby, or the generate script, has automatically generated this template. So first of all, with embedded Ruby, there are basically four tags, or four styles of tags to worry about. This one just runs Ruby code. And it's not Ruby code that you want to actually display, you just want to do something for its side effect. If you want to display it, if you want to print it out, you just stick an equal sign there. And so when you're running standard Ruby, remember, you could just do a puts, and that would print something out, and then that would just work. You don't want to do puts within your templates. Basically, this has to do with everything's a value. You're not printing things to standard out. Standard out would just go to your logs or might just go nowhere. So if you stick a minus sign at the end, then it swallows the next new line. And so this is important in some things like when you're generating emails and you want to have everything nicely formatted in HTML, it doesn't matter if you have an extra new line. But so more concretely, so here this thing will render as P, and then the next line is this line. And then you will have a line that's just the emails to, and then you'll have a new line at the end of that. If you wanted to actually have your new line, or if you want to know the new line, so in other words, so that it would be the to field of your email and this ending tag all on the same line, you'd have to put a minus there. And similarly, you can put both the minus and the equals. Those are the four styles you need to know, pretty simple, should just make sense. So what are those funny H's doing there? Well, this is an unfortunate part of Ruby, is that it doesn't do this automatically. So in Django, which is a Python framework, it automatically escapes your HTML for you unless you tell it not to. Because unfortunately, this is a source of the biggest, one of the biggest sources of insecurities in Ruby on Rails applications is people forgetting to put H's. And so what this does is this just escapes HTML. So what does that mean? Well, for example, let's suppose that email.to contains HTML itself. For example, it could be a link to some evil site. Well, if you don't put the H in, it will just spit out that HTML code, and that will render exactly as your evil attacker, whoever it is that put that there, intended it to be, which is not good. You don't want to have a link to some evil site. Alternatively, you could inject scripts. You could put in script tags that lets you run JavaScript. Not a great idea. So putting in the H's escapes the HTML, and it basically, and you'll see something like this when you start working on your next pset, but you can convert these less than tags, or these less than signs to the HTML code, and basically everything renders as you think it should render, rather than actually turning into a link, and so render it verbatim. So the H's are important. You probably won't catch them in testing because you don't put in things like this into your to field, but it's important to do nonetheless. So HTML injection equals bad, unless you're a hacker, in which case it's great. Okay, so the controller has one method for each action. So an action is just something you would like to do. So the top of the emails controller just looks like this. So here's the index action, which if you remember, there's an index.html.erb file that corresponds to this. And so by default, when you end up calling this action, it will render that view. And so again, we have the same sort of inheritance going on here. Emails controller inherits from application controller, which again just provides a lot of Rails magic to make things work. And by default, if you go to the URL, myapplication.com/emails or /emails.xml or .html, I suppose, it will be mapped to this action in your controller. And so the actual mapping is handled in routes, which we'll talk about in a bit. But what matters is that you end up calling the index action, and then within here, you can call whatever sort of Ruby code you want. Any instance variables, which remember, instance variables are just variables that are prefixed with an @, are directly accessible within the view. And so if you remember, we go back a little bit, over here, we had an at email. And so what this means is that in the show method of the controller, so there was just a def show, et cetera, someone defined an at email. And generally, you do that by someone passes you an ID, and you look up the ID, and then you store whatever value was found in the database there into the at email. So this is how the controller passes on the values that it stole from the model to the view. So here, this will just grab all of the emails in the database, stick them in here, and then it'll render either HTML or it'll render XML, depending on which one you asked for. So this is what it comes with out of the box. I think in Rails 3, it's going to come with a little bit more out of the box. But this is definitely enough to get started. So by default, the controller's name, the controller's view has the same name as the action. So index.html and index show.html and show. There is one thing to note, which is that not all actions have their own view. So for example, there is a create method within the controller. So what this is for is I went to new, got the new.html.erb template, filled that out, and then I submit it. It hits the create action. The create action just goes ahead and actually creates that object, stores it in the database, and then it just redirects you. It doesn't render anything. It redirects you to the show. So the workflow there is new, goes to create. Create doesn't show you anything. It just redirects you to the show method. And so you don't actually have to render anything. You could just have a redirect. Or if you want to, you could render someone else's template. It's up to you. It's all very configurable, but just remember, there's convention over configuration. So in other words, everything should just work by default. And if you want to do things your own way, you can. So also controllers, remember they initialize variables for the view. We got that emails is equal to email.all, and we were able to just use that in the view. You can respond differently based on the requested type. So this is actually really powerful. It's really annoying to do this in a lot of other languages. If you tried to build this up in PHP, you'd be like, this is evil. I don't want to maintain this. So by default, you can do HTML and XML. So, okay, how does the actual mapping of URLs to actions in your controller work? Well, you use the config.routes.rb. So within the routes.rb file, you just specify things as resources, and this automatically provides the create, read, update, delete things that you need to do, and it provides the standard mapping. You can also do custom things. There are lots of comments in this file that explain exactly how everything works. So it's not too hard to do if you want to customize it, if you want to configure it yourself. If you want it to just be the default, you just declare it as resources. And so if you notice, Rails is also doing some funny things with pluralization, right? We passed it email when we did the script generate scaffold. We just said email, and now it's saying emails. Well, one thing that I really like about Rails is that it actually knows how to pluralize things. So it will actually correctly pluralize anything. Well, I mean, within reason, but like it will correctly do datum to data. If there's anything it doesn't do correctly, you can just put it into a file, and that'll just work. And so it does the plural version when it should do the plural version, right? So it's saying that you have a bunch of emails, and this is a resource, or resources, I suppose. All right, so.
Do you think if you zoomed out or something, the text would get on there or not?
Unfortunately, no. Yeah. So this is not a zoom issue. This is part of this is just line wrapping. So this is a Beamer presentation, which is a LaTeX thing, and so this is a PDF that I can't really edit easily. So, yeah. But this is a file. If you want to see what it actually is, you can just look at the file. All right, so the database configuration stuff. So by default, Rails sets you up with SQLite. You can easily change it to be MySQL just by passing it a --, database MySQL option. And that will change it so that everything's set up to use MySQL. This is YAML, by the way. Like I said, very simple, right? So the idea is you have development, and then whenever you have these tabs, that just means that you have the adapter living under development. And you don't actually have to worry about manipulating this. If you want to start doing your own config files and stuff like that, then sure, you can learn how to use the Ruby YAML library. But at the moment, you just have to know how to edit it. And edit it, just don't put lots of tabs over here. That will mess things up. But for SQLite, you don't have to edit anything. For MySQL, you might have to put in your username, your password, etc. So SQLite, by the way, is just basically a flat file. So you don't have to do any sort of special package installs. I don't really know what would happen if you tried to do this on, I guess you do have to do the SQLite 3 Ruby gem. But if you try to do this on Windows, I don't know. There's probably something you have to download. All right, so there are lots and lots of other files, and I could go on all day talking about them. But the nice thing is that you don't have to touch them for now. Because as I said before, Ruby on Rails, convention over configuration. Everything just works. You only have to edit the things that you want to do differently. All right, so a few more things. There's Rake, which comes with Rails. This is a task language. So you've been using make, and you've probably noticed that, well, you probably only used it for compiling C code. But it turns out that make is useful for a lot more than that. And rake is useful for even more than that. So you actually don't have to worry about any compilation because this is a scripting language. You don't have to compile it. But there's still lots of tasks you want to do. Like if you want to set up your database, or if you want to, so I guess I'm only showing some database things here, so for create, collation, etc. If you want to see all of the tasks that Rails provides you out of the box, you run rake-t. And so this is a Ruby thing, not just Rails, but it's very, very useful because you can put in sort of the standard tasks that you might want to do, just put these into a file, and then you just run rake, and you specify which one you want to do. So it's pretty simple. So rakedb migrate is going to be one that you're going to need. Also rakedb create if you're using MySQL. But all that this does is it just takes all of your pending migrations, creates the appropriate tables with whatever fields have been specified. And so, wait a second. How did rake know that it needed to create the emails table? So I didn't do anything else in between showing you this slide and all the other stuff. So I didn't edit any files. I just ran the script, generate scaffold, and now it knows that there's an emails table. Well, it can't just know it, right? The computer doesn't have a sense of just knowing. The Rails answer is, you know what? Don't worry about it, unless you want to do it differently. So if you want to create your own migrations, etc., you can worry about where they're stored. Or for the curious, it's just in DB migrations. It generates a file, and there's some cool kind of code that lives there. You can make your own. There's actually a script generate migration script if you want to generate some custom migration. This is pretty cool. You never have to actually build the tables in your database, as you will have to in PSET 6. So, yes. So in order to really see how useful Rails is, you have to do PSET 6 first. So how can we test out our app? So maybe we've made some changes, or maybe we just want to see what it looks like out of the box. Just run script server. What this will do is this will run in the foreground a server. By default, it's Webrick. If you have something better, like Mongrel installed, as I apparently do, it will run that. And it will say that it's running this on 0.0.0.0:3000. What this means is just localhost 3000. So if you go in Firefox to localhost :3000, you will see your application. And it just tells you that you can run it as a daemon, or you can just shut it down. And so this is the development server. To do it in production, you want to do something else. But we can talk about that later. So that's enough to get started. So we've gone over the basic MVC, we've gone over where things live. There's a lot of documentation out there. So how can you learn more about it? Well, reading other people's code is a very good place to start. There are a lot of open source Rails applications out there. There are a lot of tutorials online. Documentation, your friend. You can use rake to generate guides. So if you rake.guides, what this will do is this will generate a bunch of very informative tutorial type things. I guess it's more on the level of documentation than straightforward tutorials. But then you can just access these locally. There's also api.rubyonrails.org, which sometimes can be a little bit cumbersome to navigate until you've gotten really used to it. I know that I've spent a lot of time Googling specific methods, and when you have errors, you're like, now I have to go Google this one as well. I guess Google I should put up here as a very good friend for documentation. Reading a book, this is probably the best thing to do. Agile Web Development with Rails is a standard book. This was linked on the Ruby on Rails website, and it's pretty much just amazing. I also have two copies of this, so if you want to, I can lend you a copy. And the caveat here is a lot of things get obsolete very quickly because Rails, the development cycle, is extremely rapid. So remember how I said that there's about 2 years in between major releases? Well, between minor releases, it's very rapid. And there are a lot of things that change within that time. So in particular, if you find any tutorial on Ruby on Rails 1, it's completely worthless. If you find anything on like 2.2 and below, it's mildly useful. But so this book, it came out, it was 2.2, I believe, and it came out like a week before 2.3 was released. So it was already obsolete before it was published. And that's how fast these things develop. But so there's no really good tutorial online, which is very unfortunate because this is really good. But all right, so let's build this app. So I actually have a bunch more slides after this. I'm not sure if we're gonna have time to get to them. I think we might. Okay, so let's see how we can actually build this thing. So first of all, I don't suppose anyone has Rails installed, right? Okay, so then you cannot follow along. But if you did, then you could. Okay, so stop me at any time if you have any questions, by the way.
Can you
make it bigger? Sure. Okay. So first of all, to get started, you just run Rails email queue. Okay, whoa, it just created a lot of things. And if you notice, it created things in public, 500 HTML, so that if you have an internal error, it will display something pretty. You have config, and you can see that it creates temp and everything with an app. Okay, but we don't have anything that's actually useful at the moment. We don't have any dynamic content, no models yet. So we can do a script generate scaffold. So scaffold, remember, just creates model view and controller. We want to make an email. And I don't remember all the fields that we had, but we said we wanted to have a to, which was a string. We wanted to have a from, which was a string. And say we want to have a body, which is a text. And editors, which is a text. And a send at, which is a date time. So there we go. Created everything. And here's our migration that it created. And so we can do a rakedb create. I'm not even sure if I have to do that. Right. Oh, I apparently do not have the SQLite 3 gem installed. Is that right? Oops. Yep, such is the danger of live demonstrations. Luckily, we can just change this over to a MySQL database, which I actually have MySQL installed here. So database MySQL. And so it wants to overwrite the config.yaml. So yes, I do want to overwrite that. Yes, I do want to overwrite that. Sure, I want to overwrite that. Okay. So now we can do the script generate. Oops, I am failing at that. That's okay. Yar. So of course, we haven't created the database yet. This is MySQL, so I created the database. And now we do our migration. Okay. So now we've got everything set up. Let's take a look at what it actually looks like. So script server it, and go to localhost 3000, and we will promptly get the default page. All right, so let's see if everything's running. If this page did not show anything, then everything would not be running, because this actually talks to your application directly. This is actually just a static HTML page otherwise. This is also a JavaScript fail, if you notice. But OK. So how do you get rolling? We already know this. Who cares about that? So what we should do is we should get rid of that file, which is in public, index.html. Can boot this back up again and reload. So nothing matches slash. But if you notice, this is within Rails. Things are working. This is excellent. So you can go to slash emails, which is the default route for that. This is a little bit cut off. That's a little bit better. Okay. So if you notice, we have these two from body editor send at. It just creates an HTML table, and it'll populate that with whatever emails you make. So let's say we want to send something to me from me, saying hello. And as editors, I will put me, and I'll put my Gmail. OK. And then we can do a send at. Unfortunately, everything's cut off.
You can zoom out if you need to.
Yeah, I may have to do that. Here, let me resize the window. Perfect. All right. Now we can scroll down, send out. Ooh, it made a pretty date time field for us. So let's not send it yet. Let's send it at 30. Oh, so also it does, by default, it does UTC 0. So basically the time zone here is off, if you didn't notice. But you can change that. You can set it very easily with one line change in environment.rb. And cool, it's displaying our email properly. And if we go back to emails, you'll notice that it's displaying it. We have a show, edit, destroy methods already attached to it. We could go ahead and do all this dynamic magic. So it's important to keep in mind that this object actually lives in a database somewhere. And somewhere is actually on localhost. I'm running a MySQL server, but we don't have to worry about that. So here's the output of the server. It took all of the requests. So for show, for index, it shows you the SQL queries that it's running, and it shows you just what's going on. So pretty straightforward. All right, so let's go ahead and try to make this a little bit more custom, right? Because at the moment, we're not really doing anything all that interesting. So open up email. So again, this is just very bare bones. So well, what sort of methods do we want? Well, we want after it is updated. So after update, let's say do send, right? So after it's updated, we want to send off the an email to either the editors or if the appointed time has come, we also want it to be sent out. So I guess like do send revision. Okay, now the question is, how do we actually have Ruby send or Rails send email? Well, the way that we do this is through script generate. So you can generate something called a mailer. So let's see what the documentation is for this. So if you just run it with no options, then you get this screen, which tells you how it works. You pass it the mailer name and then whatever options you want. And so the mailer that I want, well, let's call it email mailer, which I guess any mailer should be sending emails anyway. But so we want a revision mailer, or we want a revision action on this, and also it's called a production for the actual thing that gets sent out. Okay, cool. So now if you notice, it just generated a bunch of magic for us. So, all right, so where does the mailer live? It lives within models, so we can pull that up. So if you notice, it already created the default actions for the things that we want to send. I guess I could do this in terminal, actually. That might be easier. So app models, so Emacs, no window, email, mailer. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. So for the revision, let's just say this is a subject. Revision requested. Okay, so who should be the recipient? Well, first of all, what do we need in order to do this? We should pass in an email object. And so the recipient should be the email dot editors, that's what we called it, and from should be email dot from. Sent out can be the same, and body, if you notice, this is an options hash. We don't have the braces because we don't want to mix it up with a block. And let's say email gets email. So what this does is, within the body of the email, we will be able to access this object as just the local variable email. And similarly, for production, we want to do something very similar. And so let's email that subject. Well, I suppose we should also put the actual subject here. So email.subject. So all I did there was string interpolation. So in Ruby, you have to do double quoted string, and then you can do pounds and then braces. You can run arbitrary code inside of this, which is very cool because you can do whatever you want. Within PHP, you can kind of get at that, but not really. Within C, you have to do a printf. And as you all know, printifs are very annoying. So recipient should be email.to. Did I do this right? Yes. And still should be email.from, send.at, and email. Okay, so we've set up the model for the mailer. So I'm doing something a little bit different from what I was talking about before. Before I was just talking about handling web requests. So here, what we're talking about is handling emails. So you still have the same model view controller separation, except you don't have a controller. So the controller is you. You have to deal with this in your own other code, and there is a model and there's a view. So this was the model. Where does the view live? Well, the view lives in app views and email mailer. So if you notice, there are two files here, production and revision. By default, it just looks like this. So the revision should be someone has requested your assistance in editing this email. So if you notice, it thinks that it's Ruby. So I'm going to turn that off. Let's turn like HTML mode. Okay, there we go. So then I remember these tags. So this tag will print out whatever is passed in here. And email.body. Okay. So what this will do is this will just create an email that looks like this, and it will allow us to just send it. So now how can we actually send it? Well, let's open up models email.rb. So after update, no, actually let's do after save. So after update would only be like if it's already created. So this way, anytime we edit it, it will send out a revision. We're going to do an email mailer dot deliver. What did we call it? Oops. We called it revision. So here's some Rails magic that comes into play, is that we have this email mailer, which has a method called revision. If we want to send an email, we just do deliver underscore method name. All right. And of self. So self is the way that within an object you talk about itself. So this thing will pass itself as a parameter to revision. So from this, we're able to generate some nice email. So at this point, we should have enough to actually do that. So we go down, open up script server. Let's refresh the page. Okay, and let's just do the same sort of thing. Okay, sure enough, myself as an editor again. Send it, yeah, whatever else with that. Create, okay, so undefined method. So first of all, this means that there is a bug in our code. And, okay, right. So a nice thing about Ruby on Rails is that it provides you with a very nice backtrace. You don't have to open up GDB. It just gives you everything that you need. So if you notice, this file just lives somewhere random. We don't want to have to deal with that. That's not our code, not our responsibility to mess around with. Can we just break here?
Sure.
Okay. We're good? All right, cool. So we have a bug, and we have to find this bug. But luckily, it's really easy to find, because it tells us right here that in email mailer.rb line 5, we had a bug. So open it up. Is this where things were living? Oh, yes. This is where things were living. So we had a bug on line 5 of email mailer. So opening up Emacs. Emacs is a very nice editor to use, by the way. Line 5. So this is line 5. And so it says that there was no method subject. So apparently I forgot to create subject in my model. And is this true? This is indeed true. OK, well, I guess we're going to have to nuke that. We could add that very easily by creating a migration. But we will not go into that right now. So also, we don't have to restart the server. Since it's running in development mode, it will just work. It'll just pick, basically, it looks for any files that have been updated and just reloads those ones. So I successfully created that email. And now, since we had that after save hook, or yes, I believe it was an after save hook, Here, let me just exit this so I don't open it. Since we have this after save hook, it's supposed to do send revision. It will actually deliver that revision. Now, since it's running development mode, by default, it doesn't actually send email. So the idea is that you should be able to do everything in a sandbox, and you shouldn't really care if you're spamming people. And so it doesn't actually send any email, but what it does is just prints it to standard out. And so if you notice, this is the email that would have been sent. It would have sent out exactly what we wanted it to be. Does it make sense? So to actually have it do this, all you have to do is put it into production mode, or alternatively, you can edit some configuration settings within your config directory, and it will actually send it. Okay, so now anytime anyone edits an email, it will be sent. So how can we deal with sending it out once the appropriate time comes? Well, what we can do is we can create an instance method of the class. And so remember, everything in Ruby is an object. And so in particular, what this means is that classes are objects as well. And so they can have instance methods. And so the way that you denote an instance method within an object like this is you do self.foo. And so what this would mean is that you could run email.foo as a class method, and that will just run as you want it to run. So we'll have a class method that will find all pending. And so what this does, what we want this to do is to find everything in the database that should be sent. So what do we want to do? We want to do find, and then conditions. So the condition should be that send at should be greater than or equal to now. And actually, I think you have to do find all. Okay. So this would be one way of doing it, is so that you explicitly put in a find all, and then you pass it conditions. And so this is the way that you interact with Ruby, or the Ruby interacts with the database, is through this magical method on the class called find. You can pass it conditions, you can pass it order by, you can pass it a bunch of other options. All of this is documented, and it's very important to figure out if you want to do any sort of custom lookup or filtering of your models. So this would work, but I want to do something a little bit more fancy just to show you that it's possible, which is named scope. And so this is some magic where you just take find options, you put them onto named scope, and it does the same sort of thing, but it also allows you to keep it at one level higher of abstraction. Basically, when you actually do this find, it will actually run the find. And it will go to the database, it will return them as a list of objects. If instead you want to keep it as a lazy sort of evaluation so that you can chain these things together and you can run multiple filters, you should use named scope. And so the code looks exactly the same. So that should not be a sent at. That should be a send at. And we can just nuke this. And so now, in our controller, what we want to do is before filter. So before any of these things are called, we should do a send pending. And so we don't want it to be callable from the web, so we declare it private and send pending. And so what this should do is this should do an email dot do send. Wait, that's wrong, sorry. Email dot, we have to give it a name, pending. Dot pending, so and dot all. So now we'll grab all of these from the database, dot each. Let's pass it a block now where we take in an email and we do email mailer dot send email mailer. So remember, so send product or deliver production is exactly what we want. Email. And so what this would do if we finish sketching it out, but I want to get to some of my other slides, so we won't go through that, is this would, anytime anyone requests the application, so actually we can go ahead and refresh the page, it's going to give us an error, of course, is it would go to the database, pick out everyone that needs to be sent, and then actually send it. And so right here, in about 5 or 10 lines of code, we managed to implement, in a bare-bones sense, exactly what I've been talking about. And so this is the power that is Rails. All right. So hope that that was informative. Let's go back to some slides. All right. So first of all, how do you install it? Well, in Linux, this is pretty easy to do, with one caveat, which is you need to watch out for missing C header libraries. So in particular, if you wanted to set it up with MySQL, which you do, on just some fresh install, maybe a VM, something like that. And you guys all know about the CS50 VM. Okay, so if you have that up and running, you can just apt-get install RubyGems, MySQL Server 5, and the libmysql client 15-dev. And you should make sure to update the gem package. And so what gem is this is a package manager for Ruby, just like apt-get is a package manager for Ubuntu. And so it helps you manage, well, gems, which are just bundles of Ruby code. And unfortunately, the one that's in pretty much any repository is out of date because Ruby development is very, very fast. And so you just have to update system, and it updates itself to the newest version, and also install Rails and SQL. OK. So on Windows, if you really want to do this, you can use WAMP. But on the whole, you're on your own. I'm not going to help you there. Like, I did this, and it was annoying, and I don't want to do it again. So what's a good editor? Well, NetBeans is pretty good if you get the right plugins. This runs just fine on Linux, runs fine on Windows too. Aptana Studio on Rails, this is also good. It's basically just Eclipse with a plugin installed. The only problem is I've never actually gotten this working on my Linux machine. So if any of you guys decide to go for Aptana, which is pretty good, and you manage to get it working on Linux, do let me know, because I have not been able to. TextMate is excellent. It's Mac only. It's also proprietary. I think it's about $100 to get a license for it. But this is actually the official text editor of the Rails development team. So it's really good, has a lot of excellent support for Rails, but it's limited in the sense that it's Mac only. And Emacs. Emacs is solid for any sort of editing. That's what I use. And make sure to install Ruby eLisp and YAML mode. So all right. Rails also has a very robust system for installing third-party modules. So it doesn't have its own package manager, thankfully. That would be one step too much, perhaps. But it does provide a very easy way of dealing with this, of managing these. And so there's script plugin in particular. And you just put in the URL, and you can find these online. GitHub has a lot of these, and they tell you exactly what URL you need. And you just run this command, it'll download it to vendor plugins. Now, performance. So Ruby gets a very bad rap out there because it is slow. And I'm not going to deny that. Ruby is slow. It's probably an order of 10 times slower than C. But the thing is that, you know, it doesn't really matter, right? Like, what sort of computational intensive tasks are you doing? Generally on the web, the thing that is limiting you is bandwidth. And if you're running C, if you're running Ruby, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if you take an extra millisecond because you have about 100 milliseconds worth of latency anyway. So on the flip side, sometimes you do want to do computationally intensive tasks. Sometimes you want to get some processing done. And for that, you should take that out of the standard request lifecycle. And you should offload it to something called BackgroundDB or BackgroundRB. And you can alternatively do your own sort of magic. But that should not be part of the main request cycle. The request cycle should be very quick, snappy, etc. Also, one thing that's very good for production sites is the built-in caching abilities of Rails. You should look into sweepers for getting rid of old cached data. But caching is very simple. This is really just in the view, you have two lines that you add. And you can cache whatever you want. Alternatively, you can cache it at the page level, etc. So TLAs that you should know. Does anyone know what a TLA is? Three-letter acronym. Get it? TLA itself? OK. Anyway. Except actually, this is not a TLA. Sorry. This is an FLA, I guess. But create, read, update, delete. It's important to know. Dry is also an important principle for Rails, which is don't repeat yourself. You should if you have common functionality, if you have common code, you should always refactor it. And you should always try to share such that all that you have to do is make a change once rather than having to make it in multiple places. And this is a great idea in general. Always adhere to it if possible. Ruby provides some very excellent things such as mixins, which you might want to look up. This is, you use the include keyword and you can pass it a module, and basically you then get access to all the methods in that module. It's very useful and allows you to do that. This is also not a TLA. Nuts. Well, there are only three words. So REST is something that Rails allows very easily. So REST is a big buzzword out there. Representational state transfer basically allows you to interact via calling, or via GET, POST, and several other HTTP actions to interact with a remote application. So basically you can deal with these things from a programmatic perspective without really having to worry about how they're represented. It's very nice. So I18N, which is internationalization. You might ask, why is that I18N? Well, there are apparently 18 letters in between the I and the N. And so in Rails, 2.2, it might have been 2.3 that they added support for this, where basically you just do I18N.t, and then you pass it an identifier that looks up in a YAML table that you populate and can translate it to various languages. And so then that can be set by the application. It can be set just by looking at where the person's coming from to be in whatever language you want. And so you could implement your own sort of thing like Facebook has, and you could have your own pirate English and do whatever. So how many of you guys have used pirate English on Facebook? Anyone? No one? You should really do it. You can go to your Facebook account and at the bottom, instead of English, do pirate English. You can make your site do that. Very easy to do. So almost. You have to populate that file by yourself. It doesn't give you built-in translation abilities. It just provides support for doing it. JavaScript. So JavaScript allows you to make HTML pages dynamic. You'll be doing this in a later CS50 problem set. And Rails comes with its own templating language called RJS. And it lets you do easy Ajax, so you can talk to your server and do all sorts of dynamic things. And so the sort of code for doing this is very simple. You do page.something, and you pass it Ruby code, and out pops JavaScript. It's very simple to use, and you can make great-looking applications very easily. So other things, unit tests. So testing is good, because you never really know if your code is doing what you think it's doing. And in particular, it may be doing what you think it's doing at a certain point in time. You make a change, and later on, it's no longer working. With unit tests, you write them once, and then you can run these anytime you make a change, anytime you want to make sure your application is still working properly. So there's great support for this. Whenever you generate anything, generate a model, generate a controller, etc., Ruby also, or Rails also creates the corresponding test file for it. So error handling, you can set it up so that it emails them to you, for example. This is really good for production applications where they're out there and you don't really want to have to check the logs all the time. Well, you should probably check the logs anyway in case the email to yourself thing is broken. You can do custom logging. It provides very simple support for that. Pluralization, as I mentioned, is also great because it just works just magically. And you just can take a string and you can do dot pluralize, for example. So deploying. So how do you take a Rails application that you've been working on and put this into production? Well, so last year CS50 provided people with accounts on Dreamhost. I don't know if they're going to do that again. You are welcome to come to HCS and be like, I want to be able to deploy my Rails application. And we'd be like, okay. But so that's on sort of the social side. On the actual technical side, how do you do this? So you should see the README. They tell you how to do this with htaccess and fastcgi. This is something you can do in a shared host. Basically, you redirect requests to a script, essentially, that then loads up the Rails framework and does things from there. That's a little bit inefficient if you're doing something that's really computationally intensive, or you know, you're expecting a lot of traffic, essentially. You should be on your own host, and you should be using either Passenger or Mongrel. So Twitter, in particular, had a lot of scaling issues, and I'm not sure if you follow them that much, but there's been a lot of talk about maybe Twitter's going to switch off of Rails, but they haven't done it because they managed to make it scale. So I think that they started out with a bunch of Mongrel clusters, and I'm not really sure what they're doing at this point. So the conclusion, Ruby on Rails is awesome. And slides are posted there. So, all right, I believe that's all that I have. So any questions? All right, well, I guess that's easy enough. But thank you guys for coming, and hope that you found that enjoyable and useful and informative.